Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is October 1st, 2009, Thursday evening. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. This evening is our third quarter wrap-up. I'd like to pause at the end of each quarter and at the end of each year to take the long view, sort of look back and look forward. Where are we? How are we doing? I find it's really important if we're going to stay in alignment with the long-term trends to keep coming back to that, not get distracted by the overwhelming amount of information that flows into all of us. And I like to brief you on sort of what I see and what it's going to mean to us, and particularly our time and resources. So our theme tonight is America at the Crossroads. The American people are now moving into a significant shift. We're starting to realize as a people that this is not just another recession. This is a real fundamental change of institutions that we're dealing with. And the next few years are going to be a period of significant change. It's more than critical that we create and align that which is new and is birthing, and that's why it's so important to see the long-term trends, and that which is positive for us, and let go of that which is dying or is not so positive for us. So first, money and markets. A couple big stories this week, or really in the last week and a half. The most important story, I think, is we're watching gold, the gold price hovering at or near 1,000. The floor that Franklin Sanders and I keep talking about is 1,000, seems to be holding. It's important because it's an important psychological level, and it's important because it's an indicator of how the dollar is doing as a reserve currency. We have the new head of the World Bank warning us that the U.S. dollar is not going to be the reserve currency forever. And I think one of the questions to ask about gold is, if national sovereignty went away tomorrow, what's the currency that you could trust? And I think that's having a significant impact on creating a floor on the gold price. Another important story was the G20 meeting in Pittsburgh. What we saw was two things happening. One is we're watching slowly G20 replace G8. So we're going to a group of essentially North America, Europe, and Japan to something which is much more balanced, the 20 nations representing, they say, 85% of the world economy, but much more balanced in terms of global representation and, of course, including the BRICS. I was just reprimanded yesterday that BRICS not only includes Brazil, Russia, India, and China, but now we add the KS for Korea and Singapore. Another important thing happened at G20, and that was you're watching the creation of a real sense of we among the leaders who come to G8. And when I say we, is that they have much more in common with each other than they have with the people of the nations that they're supposed to represent. So we're watching at a very deep level, a sort of shift of identity in who's who and who represents we's in this world. And it's all part of sort of shifting out of the national sovereignty model. The last thing we saw is many more Americans become aware of the kind of weaponry that is about to be rolled out domestically. We had sonic weaponry being used. There were kind of a funny face-off, 12,000 what some people refer to as stormtroopers. Paul Roberts, the former Assistant Secretary of Housing, Assistant Secretary of Treasury, referred to them as stormtroopers, but 12,000 stormtroopers against 300 students, and of course they were using these invisible weaponry. In the early 90s, the Department of Defense created a joint venture with the Department of Justice, and the goal of the venture was to help the Department of Justice prototype and test out what's called non-lethal weapons or invisible weaponry in domestic situations and in a kind of structure where they could then introduce it to the local police. And I ended up in the 90s for a variety of reasons doing a lot of research into non-lethal weapons and invisible weaponry. But one of the reasons to even recognize it or think about it is it really informs tactics and why it's much more powerful to shift your banks and your money than to necessarily go march up against stormtroopers with this kind of weaponry. Anyway, but G20, the G20 meeting in Pittsburgh was really showed a real shift towards global elites managing through corporations as opposed to governments, is my prediction. Third story, Federal Reserve is the mortgage market. We had stunning disclosure, you can read about it up on the blog, that if you look at how many mortgages the Fed has bought so far this year, it's more than the mortgage, or if you look at the mortgage-backed securities they've bought, the principal amount is more than all the mortgages issued, which means that the Fed is literally the mortgage market. Now, my guess is what the Fed is doing is buying capacity out of the banks, and that puts the banks in a position to originate more. It proves again that inflation does not have to happen, because what we're watching is the Federal Reserve prove that they can print as much money as they want. Now, in the category of it just keeps getting weirder, there again, also on the blog, all the stories I always relate to, describe in Money and Market, or you can find up on the blog. A private military company has shown up in Hardin, Montana, with a Mercedes SUV stamped Hardin Police Force. So you have a private military company. They're there to negotiate the takeover of a prison which has been built but is empty. And but they're showing up with these SUVs stamped as if they're the town police force. One of the most fascinating stories I've heard, and if there's any interest, I'll get some of these guys on the Solari report. The farm, which is an intentional community in Summertown, Tennessee, discovered one day that a private military company was trying to buy land next to them to do a training camp. They're very committed to peace and nonviolence, so they went to work. They have a couple of very smart lawyers there. They went to work and proceeded to basically kick the private military company back to from whence they came. And it's one of the great stories of local action. It wasn't that long ago. It didn't happen that long ago. But I suspect there's a lot of places around the country that are going to be facing these issues as private military companies get more and more government contracts to provide a variety of different functions. It's really important, if you've read the stories of what happened in New Orleans during Katrina, it's really important to be very careful around these guys. They have legal authorities or protections that a governmental entity doesn't have. So it's, you know, it can be a dangerous situation. Number five story, I wanted to report on the conference that I attended last week, Financial Permaculture Convergence in Hohenwald, Tennessee. We had a much smaller group than last year intentionally, and we did some intensive workshops on a variety of things, including one I did called Mapping Your Financial Ecosystem. And there were some fascinating insights that came out of it. One is I realized that many of the people who came there thought of mapping your financial ecosystems as something, you know, that you can get software tools to do, and you can go on Google and you can figure out how the money works in your place. And what we hadn't realized and what needed to be said was that the first step in understanding and mapping your financial ecosystems is adopting a protocol personally and culturally that says, I care about what my colleagues, my neighbors, my friends, my family, I care about how their money works. I take an interest in it, and I look for ways of helping them be successful with their resources and with their finances. And I look for ways to align, and I believe that it's possible if I find ways of adding value to them that it will add value to me. It's sort of a culture of your blessing blesses me. And so step one is really taking a personal and intimate interest in understanding other people's economics for the opportunity to find win-wins with them. It's much more an attitude in terms of step one as opposed to collecting or looking at a lot of data. And it's interesting, if you do that in your life, if you go through your life taking an interest in how people's money work in a way that is positive, you know, you will, in fact, start mapping your local financial ecosystems. So think about how you can start to get interested in how other people's finances work for the purpose of helping them succeed. Another thing that came up was we had a variety of different conversations around fear. If you look at the most recent polls, what it will show is that Americans are feeling more and more afraid, and there was a real desire on the part of many of the people participating to do things that were positive and encouraged people. And so what came up was, of course, being a money person, I'm always very interested in early identification of all risks and managing things so that we make money, we don't lose money, and so denial is very dangerous in my model. So, you know, of course, I was always there saying, oh, wait, we got to deal with the real risks. And when I left, what I realized, you know, we're dealing, as Americans, we're dealing with three things. And it's not just Americans, because a lot of people in the first world are dealing with this right now. The first thing is, you know, there's a tremendous number of false fears. If you turn on corporate media, there's all sorts of phony baloney fears that are being pushed at us that just, it's funny, I went to the medical clinic this morning. I was only there for an hour and they marketed about five things all designed to, you know, trigger massive amounts of fear. So there's a lot of false fears. The war on terror is the most common one I think we all deal with when we sit in the airport and listen to the color is orange. So there's a lot of false fears. Then there's what I call real fears about false fears, which is if you're in a business that is very much affected by enforcement and regulation, particularly strict federal regulation, and a lot of it is not real, but you've got to treat it like it's real because it could be real to you. There's a real risk. You live in a litigious society. So there's a lot of real fears about false fears, and I find it's really helpful when you're having to manage that to just have a little perspective on it and not take it too much to heart. And then finally, they're real fears. They're things that really do provide risk. And my feeling, very much in line, if you didn't hear Lawrence Gonzalez's interview on the last Solari report, I really recommend it to you. But he talks about how important it is for survival to face the real risk issues and deal with the uncertainties. And the faster you do it, the better. So that's kind of our spirit here. The faster we deal with the real risks, the better. And I wanted to tell another story in that vein. I have a Solari Circle, and we decided recently that we would try and come up with an investment strategy for the planet. If we were, the simulation was, if we were in charge of all the money, how would we manage the sort of equity investment on the planet? And we can sit and criticize Mr. Global, but it's another thing to put yourself in his shoes and understand what you would do. So off we went, and one of the things we started with, we said, okay, let's say the total equity wealth on the planet today is X. So it's X dollars. All financial equity is X dollars for the entire planet. How much could it be if we simply optimized equity investment without consideration to, you know, who got it? So rather than trying to centralize control of the wealth, we just said, okay, we want to optimize the financial wealth. And the differences varied, but I basically said that our current wealth was less than 1% of what it could be if it was freely optimized. Various other people, I think, were at about 20%. But clearly the conclusion of the group was that our current wealth was significantly less than what was possible. And what came out of that conversation was that what was absent was not a failure to... We're not suffering from a failure to invest in positive things. What we were experiencing was tremendous centralization of wealth in very negative ways and profiteering from organized crime and warfare that simply was shrinking the wealth, shrinking markets, shrinking trust, doing enormous damage And really what we were dealing with was a political problem. So then question number one became, okay, well, if we wanted to take it from wherever it is today, less than 1% up to 100%, how do you stop these guys from doing what they're doing? Which, of course, led us back to the age-old question, who are these guys and why are they doing what they're doing? And so I tell you that story to just say that what we're dealing with is not an economic problem. We don't have an economic problem on this planet. We have a political problem, and the faster we can face our political problem, the faster we can start to practice successful predator evasion and do it in a way that will hopefully start to shift things. So that's it for money and markets. It was a very intense time at Financial Permaculture Convergence, very interesting. I can't say enough positive about the permaculture community. I think permaculture is something, one of the really wonderful developments on this planet. I encourage everyone to learn more about it. Okay, Ask Catherine. We just keep getting wonderful questions, and so I've got a whole bunch I want to run through. First question, during the call with Cliff High of Half Past Human, a reference, as I understood it, was made to the connection between the heavy aerial spraying over populated areas in the U.S. during the past 5+ years and the incidence of autoimmune disorder in the general population. Is there any more information available on this? I don't know of any specific research or studies on the correlation between the growth of autoimmune disorders and the spraying is often referred to as chemtrails. What I would, if you wanted to research this more, here's where I would start. There's a wonderful documentary up on YouTube about chemtrails called Aerosol Crimes. And at the end, in the last 5 to 10 minutes, there's a very interesting interview with a health practitioner who describes her views on how to protect yourself from chemtrails. And what I would do is identify her, see if you could find her, and find more research on that topic. Another place you might check is Will Thomas is one of the journalists who's done the most coverage and writing on chemtrails, and you might check his website to see if there's anything. You also might check the there's a large archive on Morgellons disease at Rents.com. Morgellons is often thought to possibly be connected to chemtrails, and you might dig in and see if any of those researchers know of sort of wider studies than just the Morgellons. For those of you who didn't listen to the Laura Thompson interview about how to protect yourself from swine flu or the vaccinations related to swine flu, she gave excellent information on just building up your immune systems that address these issues and many others across the board. So I would really recommend that. Okay, question number two, why are so many bankers, hedge fund, big shots dying all of a sudden? This question relates to a series of stories that we put up on the blog a week or two ago, maybe it's 3 weeks ago, about right in a 5-day period, there were a number of deaths. The CEO of Rockefeller & Company, the Rockefeller family office that's now grown into a wider institutional manager, was found dead of a gunshot wound. It was alleged to be a suicide. There was also the former chairman of Beneficial Corporation was found dead. I believe that was also a gunshot wound. A fundraiser for the governor of Illinois died in suspicious circumstances. And then someone out in a financier, young man out in L.A., also strange experiences. So the question is, what's all this about? One of the things that was interesting is these stories were the second largest hit-getters on my website, on the blog, in the third quarter. So there was tremendous interest in these stories and what was really going on. I don't know the answer. It's clearly not a good sign when the CEO of someone like Rockefeller & Company is found dead of a gunshot wound. It's hard. You know, there's so many possibilities that you hate to conjecture. It's almost, if it was a suicide, it's, you know, there's a lot of concern about what in the world is going on at Rockefeller & Company. that Rockefeller and Company manages money. The least amount they'll take in is $30 million. He was also a member of the CIT board. CIT is a financial institution that lends mostly to middle market companies and is under tremendous pressure right now and may go down. The creditors are working now to try and save the company. They've tried to get federal bailouts. So it could relate to CIT. It could relate to something going on at Rockefeller. So, you know, yes, it could have been a suicide. Could it have been an assassination? Yes. When you see four or five, you know, sort of unusual deaths right at this time, and September is definitely one of those times. You know, one possibility is that it's a sweep, and a sweep where a lot of people are getting, you know, I hate to say it, what you're doing is you're deleting a lot of witnesses to your criminal liability. So these are people. When you see that kind of assassination sweep, it's, you know, you're trying to get rid of a lot of people because the pig's trying to go through the snake, and some people just have to be thrown overboard. So it's a, you know, at certain levels, you don't get fired, you get shot. And it clearly is saying, it's clearly a sign that there's significant instability in the system, whether they shot themselves or someone else did. So it's not a good sign, and it speaks to the fragility of the system. What happens to a global commodity when the dollar totally tanks? The one stock we have hung on to is Exxon because our basis is so low. Oil prices might go up. What would happen when the dollar collapsed? Should we get out quick? It's very important when you look at securities to understand which ones are dollar sensitive and which ones are not. So if you have a stock that that has a value which is asset-based in a commodity such as oil or precious metals or could be soybeans, you know, whatever, it's even if it's denominated in the dollar, it's not going to trade with the dollar. It's going to trade according to the value of the commodity. So if it's denominated in a dollar, it doesn't mean it trades with the dollar. You don't need to worry about it. So in the particular example that the person asked on Exxon, a falling dollar will do nothing but cause the stock market or the price of an oil stock to go up if oil is going up. So you needn't worry about the dollar denomination. Where you need to worry, of course, is two things. One is if you're in a fixed income instrument that's denominated in dollars, then as the dollar falls, your purchasing power will probably fall with it unless you've got asset prices falling at the same time. The second thing is I believe we run a real significant chance over the next 6 months of the stock market taking a big hit, not just in the United States but globally, if we have to defend the bond market to protect the dollar. So and we've seen this happen a couple times in the last few years, if the Feds intervene to aggressively protect the bond market and the dollar, one of the costs of that kind of intervention could be a collapsing stock market. So just keep that in mind. Last question, do you think our military-industrial complex would be so crazy as to war with Iran, or is it just diversion or possible? My answer is I think it's possible. I have tried for about the last 6 months to really understand what is the chance that Israel or the United States or a combination of both would attack Iran, and the answer is I don't know. There are a lot of rumors that we've gotten close. I just don't know if they're true. My question here is our primary concern with Iran developing nuclear weapons, or is our primary concern with Iran becoming energy self-sufficient? Because an energy self-sufficient country in that part of the world that's not dependent on the dollar and is completely independent from quote-unquote empire, whether you see empire emanating from the United States or from Europe, will completely shift the model on the planet, particularly if they're aligned with China and or Russia or both. So it's a real wild card, and I think if the perception here is that it will shift the planet in powerful ways and the relationships or sort of the balance of power between the United States, Russia, and China, I think, yes, war is possible. Now, will the G20 allow that to happen when there are all sorts of workarounds? And my expectation is probably not, but let's see. I think it is possible, and it's still on. I keep it on my list of wild cards. If you track the blog, you can see. I think it's an important thing for us to keep our eye on. Okay, third quarter 2009. Looking back, our wrap up for the third quarter. Last at the second quarter, I went through eight sort of key events, and that's what I want to do again tonight. Eight key events. The first one, and these are. Well, it's hard to do them in order of importance. They're also important. But my number one event for the third quarter, an enormous shift in consciousness is happening in North America, an enormous shift in consciousness. Last, at the second quarter, I said the number one sort of event was that the Obama thrill is gone, and I would say part of this shift in consciousness is the Obama thrill is really, really gone. If you look at the polls, there is profound disappointment and anger and fear in the American people. Now, I find it very hard to blame Obama for this. There was an enormous, unreasonable expectation that a presidential candidate could offer real solutions that can only be the result of people regaining our individual sovereignty. One of my favorite documentaries that we haven't watched yet on the Saleri Report, but we will, is A Century of Self by Adam Curtis, where he talks about literally how we have conceded our political powers in exchange for consumer power. So while our political power and individual rights were sort of headed out the back door, we were being ever more delighted by consumer power, and part of it is the consumer power that you have inside of a bubble. So the notion that Obama could bring real solutions, given how the machinery really works and given what the economic issues are, including the fact that $4 trillion has gone missing, was an absurd expectation to begin with, and you wonder what's wrong with us that we would even contemplate it. However, we did, and so now we're watching tremendous disappointment. One of the most important events that ever happened in my life was sometime in the 90s when I realized, I remember where I was sitting in church, and I realized, you know, I used to think of myself as someone who is governed by the government. But the government is not my governor. They're just, as the Senate staffer once said to me, they're just a criminal enterprise. And I need a way to think of myself and my life as governed by something else. And that something else has to be something I am proud of being part of, something that is excellent, something that inspires me to be a better person and a better leader. And one of the things that happened during that period was someone pointed out to me, you know, they got me to go back and read the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence and the Bill of Rights, and I was reminded that our freedom in our governing documents is in North America, or certainly in the United States, our freedom comes to us by divine authority, not from any government. We the people, that is our inheritance as a divine authority. And then we give government the right to do this and that for us, and that right, of course, can be taken away. And that's the founding fathers were very clear about all of this. And so that was another important moment when I kind of left being, I continued to file my taxes and I continued to obey the laws, but I just stopped thinking as the government is anything other than, you know, something that ranged from a nuisance to even dangerous. And I've watched many other people go through that shift, and I'll tell you another story because this is such an important point. I was at church here in Hickory Valley 2 days after, or one day after 9/11, and I went to the prayer service, and I walked in, and my pastor walked up to the lectern, and he looked at everyone and said, and this is how he opened prayer service, he said, George W. Bush was anointed by God for a time such as this. And I put my head in my hands and I started to pray. I didn't know what to do because I wanted to, you know, say that that wasn't true, but I also wanted to do it in a way that was effective. And oddly enough, my pastor said, he turned to me and said, well, Austin, you worked in Washington. What do you think? Austin's my middle name, and so he's calling me by my middle name. So you used to work in Washington. What do I think? And I must tell you, for my pastor to ask my opinion at that time, I thought was a divine intervention. So I said to him, well, in my experience, the Bush family is anointed by narcotics trafficking, financial fraud, and pedophilia. And everyone in the church just went, and my pastor looked at me and he said, and he was stricken. He said, if that's true, we're lost. I said, don't be ridiculous. We don't need the Bush. People like the Bushes come and go. They're not the people, they're not the true governors here. And so, it was one of those moments where he was sort of still in the matrix and I was outside of the matrix and I was saying, come on out. We don't need them. We don't need to be dependent on them. These kinds of folks come and go. It's much more of an Italian, if you've ever spent any time in Italy, it's much more Italian approach. Governments come and go. So what you're watching is people develop a very powerful sense of we. They're leaving the consumer model. They're coming into the sort of personal sovereignty model. And they're starting to realize, we can be a we without depending or being told, what that means by them. So there's this separation going on. And it's funny, John Adams once said that the revolution was not the war. The revolution was in the hearts and the minds of the people. And so to bring about a positive shift in this situation, what we need is we need a shift in our hearts and minds. And that's what I'm watching happen. The Obama phenomena was really, it was very depressing for me because I saw all these incredibly powerful, wonderful people spending a lot of time and money going back into a channel that couldn't help them. And so the faster we get over that, that myth, the better, and the faster this consciousness keeps rising. Because the more people who shift out of that way of thinking and into saying, okay, it is what it is, how are we going to start something new, the better off we all are. So that's number one, enormous shift. Number two, the dollar workaround grows. It's such a powerful thing to be the reserve currency. I keep, I'll read these articles that say the dollar's crashing, the dollar's crashing, the dollar's crashing tomorrow. And many of them fail to understand the extraordinary dependency of global trade and all sorts of relationships, both corporate to corporate, national to national, individuals, all those transactions that depend on the reserve currency. Having that position is so, 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 so powerful. Now, to change that, for the dollar to drop, evolve into something else, to not be the reserve currency, you need to start to put into place all sorts of different alternatives, and that's what we're watching. The BRIC nations have been building the alternatives. China's beginning to issue offshore debt using its own currency. China's buying the special drawing rights. The IMF is pushing the SDR special drawing rights system. The dollar's fallen, but if you look at where the dollar's been historically, it's nowhere near where how bad it's been, and that's why we haven't seen the bond market seriously defended, but we still could. So yes, the dollar's fallen a bit this year, but it's nowhere near as low as it's been. We have the head of the World Bank, another former Goldman Sachs, are warning that the dollar will not last forever. Probably one of the most significant signs is the fact that the Fed is clearly financing U.S. markets, not the world. So the Treasury is depending on the Fed buying Treasury bonds. The U.S. mortgage market is dependent on the Fed buying U.S. mortgages or mortgage-backed securities, not the world. So, the yen carry trade has shifted over to the Fed, and it's pretty out in the open. And what's amazing is, given the news and given what's going on, how high the dollar is. One of the strategic inflection points to watch carefully within the dollar system and the changes that are going on is the FDIC system. There's huge pressure on consolidation in the banking system. That we've seen the FDIC grappling with how to the fund, their reserves are now pretty low to empty. We see them talking about getting the banks to prepay their premiums for a three-year period. And part of that is to avoid giving up their independence by going to the Fed and borrowing big time from the Fed or having to do what Fannie and Freddie did. If that should happen, if the FDIC should have to turn to the Feds, then the FDIC could begin to lose its independence and the banking system goes from control of the banks to Lord knows what else. And the political interference, if you start to see the political interference in the banking system and FDIC that you saw in the auto dealer network, that's when you start to see things that could be really pretty devastating on Main Street, not to say that what's happened to date hasn't been. Okay, event three, technology dazzles. There are so many exciting things going on in the world of technology that it's just amazing. Now, of course, some of them we love, some of them we look at and find stupefying, some of them we just hate. I put up a story this week on a machine. It was a design prize was given to the inventor of a machine that can take animal cells and grow it into meat. You look at that and you think, oh, my God, it just keeps getting weirder. One of the things, if we think about building the positive and what this new world is going to look like that's birthing, one important thing to understand is that we're entering a period where if you take all the manufacturing that's done on the planet, we should, with robotics, be able to do about 100% of the current manufacturing with possibly 2% or less of the people. And so that means what are the economics for the other 98%, and how do we make sure that world works for everybody? You know, one of the most troubling aspects of that, of course, is the industrialization of agriculture, which I keep talking about again and again, and we'll keep coming back to, because I think the most defining trend right now on the planet is literally an effort to control the seed supply and to industrialize agriculture in a way that pushes billions of people off their land in a way that is can only be described as depopulation. I know I've encouraged all of you to watch the YouTube video by Sir James Goldsmith, but I'm going to keep encouraging you to watch it, because if I could have you watch one DVD, you can buy it as a DVD on Amazon, but you can also watch it on YouTube. If there's one video that best explains what's happening in the world today, it's that one, even though it was filmed in 1994, and the fact that it was clearly understood what was about to happen then is really, really speaks to the intentionality of the thing that we're dealing with. In the technology area, I keep for the last couple of weeks, I've had the opportunity to just look at a large deal flow of venture capital, most of it from Asia. And it's amazing to watch because there are parts of the world that are growing, their economies are dynamic, and if you see what they're doing with new technology, it's just dazzling. I mean, it really is just dazzling. The other thing I try to follow on the blog, and I would encourage you to keep an eye on it and learn more about it, is nanotechnology, because it's going to have a profound impact on our world. Nanotechnology is the ability to engineer things at a molecular and submolecular level, and it really does shift what is possible in many ways, both good and bad. So I would encourage you to do it. I put up a story of one sort of machine that you swallow the different parts and they reassemble in your body and help with surgery, if you can imagine that. So technology dazzles, and it's worth keeping an eye on, because the proper application of technology to, particularly in a way that gets us in alignment with our environment, has tremendous opportunity for all of us. So keep an eye on technology. Okay, next. The states see the end game. There is a great speech that I saw about a week and a half ago by a state legislator here in Tennessee. And it was, I also had a chance to talk with one of my local representatives. And what I'm hearing from both of them is a frustration that is very, very serious. Now, these are people who are both extremely capable, extremely astute. They have, they're extraordinarily patient. If you're a successful politician in this country, you have to be extraordinarily patient. They are people who are very skilled at the detail of government and dealing with the complexity of what it takes to manage government, either at a state and local level. So these are people who are very slow to anger, but their frustration is very serious. And what they understand is if things keep going the way they're going, then there's no hope. Because what you're watching is states that have to be, they have to balance their budget, but the feds don't. They can just keep printing money. They can use that money to do a variety of things, many of which are against the state's best interest. So they're inflating away the value of the state's reserves and inflating up the expenses of the state while they're doing a series of things to businesses on Main Street that are killing the tax base of the state. One of the most important ones is health reform. Over the last couple weeks, since I talked about health reform on the Solari report, I have talked to one business after another that says, if this passes, I'm going to have to shut down. Some of the not-for-profits said they thought they could reorganize out of it. But you're talking about massive economic disruption of the place in the economy which has generated all the jobs over the last decade. Well, it's more than that, according to the Kauffman Foundation, since 1985. So if our jobs are basically coming, you know, the only jobs outside of the or that's growing outside of the military is small business. If you gut small business, you gut state and local government, and you absolutely drive unemployment up the wall. One of the things that happened we did at Financial Permaculture was I got a monopoly set, and there's a new monopoly set that's inflated. So instead of getting $500 bills, the orange bills are not $500, they're $5 million. So I got a wonderful, wonderful woman from Hohenwald who's going to be the president of the chamber next year, and I anointed her as Mr. Global. And of course, I gave her all the get-out-of-jail-free cards. And then every time she had a problem, I gave her another $5 million while everybody else, I had anointed somebody else as the rest of us. And that person, of course, had to go to jail and got all these special tax assessments. And, you know, they got all the negative cards. And what was funny about it was that the audience could really see the game. You know, they could really see how bailouts work. And how if you just keep printing money and giving it to one player and the rest have to struggle on an accountable basis, then, you know, the story can only go one way. And that's what I heard from the state legislator. What he was realizing was this can't last. And, you know, at some point we're better off taking radical action. Now, one of the things that will go up tomorrow is a document that was printed, that was put out by the Southern National Congress and sent to all the Southern governors and sheriffs, as well as all the federal representatives. Let me explain who the Southern National Congress is. A group of people who've been very concerned about the loss of civil rights went off. They studied how the Constitution of the United States was created. And they said, well, you know, let's just take the 14 southern states and let's do that. Let's just go off and have a Congress and we'll meet and we'll start figuring out, you know, an alternative plan because this thing may collapse. And what they've done now, and it'll go up on the blog tomorrow, is they've come up with an appeal to all the law enforcement in the southern states to not obey unconstitutional orders from the federal government. It's a quite amazing document. It speaks to an understanding of the same frustration that state legislator understood, and that was that we can't keep going this way. Something's got to give. There's an article I referred to in an early Saleri report in the Wall Street Journal about all the secessionist movements around the country, and noted that this Southern group has been meeting with the guys in Vermont. So we're having different parts of the political spectrum come together. It's kind of the lawful people versus organized crime. This trend is going to continue, and it's going to be very interesting to see how it plays out. And my prediction is it will play out differently in different states. And, but it's something you need to watch because it's very much bound up with the value of the dollar. And if the dollar falls a lot, or if you have trouble rolling over the Treasury securities, and for some reason the Fed can't print, it's going to really shift the balance of power between the Feds and the states in interesting ways. Okay, next, legislative and legal background, very much connected to the sort of state frustration and the sort of state consciousness, is a variety of legislation going on at the federal level, and then some battles in the courts. And my prediction is that battleground is going to get a lot more intense. At the federal legislation level, we've got the health reform, energy bill, food safety, all of them devastating to local economies and to small business, particularly in the middle of the country. Absolutely devastating. So very much something to watch vis-a-vis the state and local sort of issues. The second thing is we've had something called the MERS decisions or two decisions. The MERS, and this sounds very obscure, but it's something that could become very important. It could be what's called a trim tab. A trim tab is the rudder that turns the rudder. If you want to turn a rudder on an aircraft carrier, you don't turn the rudder, you turn the trim tab, and that turns the rudder. This could be a trim tab. The MERS system is a digital database of mortgages that has been used to track, assign, manage mortgages at the national level. And in some respects, it threatens the county recording system. And embedded in the law is who's going to really record mortgages, who owns them, where they are, the MERS system at a national level or the county recorder at a local level. This is important because if the county doesn't maintain proper records of who and owns what, it can radically change politics at a local level. Anyway, two states came out with a decision that says for purposes of foreclosing on a property, MERS is not the owner and can't foreclose. And this could have dramatic impact on the whole foreclosure situation and system, and help to radically shift power between the local level and the national level. So that's up on the blog. Keep an eye on that. There are lots of other potential battlegrounds in the tax area and in the mortgage area, and it's really going to be tax and property issues as well as national emergency rights issues that are going to be very fruitful areas of litigation. I should also mention that the GATA, of which I'm a part, has just authorized our attorneys to go forward with a litigation against the Federal Reserve related to our assertion that they did not comply with our FOIA request, Freedom of Information, on their gold arrangements. And you can read more about that up on the blog as well. So expect the legislation and legal battleground to continue. The military, and this is this area is one where we could get some real surprises in the fourth quarter. We had a report last week that Obama, the Afghan commander, said publicly that he has only spoken to Obama once since February. That's quite astonishing. particularly given the interest in committing more troops to Afghanistan. And then we had a column in Newsmax, it's up, I linked to it on the blog, saying that the columnist felt it was possible that we would see what he called a civilized military coup in this country. He described it as a family intervention, the equivalent of a family intervention, where the military would simply say, we don't like the way you're running the country and we're going to change things. Now, to me, one of the real wild cards here is the states are all very dependent on military spending. If you go to Eagle Eye, which is a website that tracks contracts and government grants, what you'll see is all states are very, very dependent on government monies, but the chief contract authority is military spending. So one of the things that's going to be interesting is you still have within the military very deep loyalty to the Constitution. The military is required to take an oath to defend and preserve the Constitution, whereas I was on Wall Street for 11 years, and I've never seen a banker who took, and I've certainly never seen a central banker who took an oath to defend the Constitution. So they're a little bit not in alignment in that area, and it's going to be very interesting to see whether the military and the state legislators start to align in ways that shift the balance of power against the banking cartel. So I would expect the military to, as we go through the fourth quarter, there's going to be an unbelievable pressure on the military because they are spread thin across the globe, and it is very hard to manage the national security in a situation where your civil leadership does not command the respect that it needs to, both within the country and outside. And by that, I don't mean Obama. I mean the bailouts and a variety of the different politics at the Washington level. If you look at the polls, a congressman is now less respected. Congressional representatives are less respected than corporate CEOs. They are the least respected profession in the country, I think, at this point. It's, according to Rasmussen, it's about 16% say that they admire their congressman or they admire Congress. So when you have a civil leadership that is in this level of disrespect, it can make it extremely dangerous for the military and the national security. So I just think it's going to be very interesting to see what they do and what the state legislators do. Okay, next up, are we safe? Gun and ammunition purchases. Well, not surprisingly, it's funny, people say to me, well, Americans don't have a plan on how to deal with this, and I keep looking at the gun and ammunition purchases, and I say, well, they appear to have a plan. Whenever you have concern for the government, or when you have a shock and awe situation, when you have a real breakdown, as the kind we saw in Eastern Europe or Russia, Latin America, you do get an increase in crime, and history argues that purchase and training in firearms and self-defense is a perfectly reasonable response. But if you look at the gun and ammunition purchases, it's quite amazing. I put up a little post on the blog about a couple months ago. I called it bailout math. It turned out over the period where and this is a gross estimation, where the bankers had gotten $12 trillion, Americans had bought 12 million guns and 12 billion rounds of ammunition. And I think there's definitely a connection between those three numbers. But it's clearly the gun and ammunition purchases are very strong, and I expect will continue to be strong. Last one, swine flu, ooh la la. I wrote an article called Swine Flu, What I Believe. It has been the number one hit getter on the blog for the third quarter, to my amazement. And the blog discussion on it, we got over 300 comments, got so fractious, I was worried that we had people proposing violence that I shut off the blog comments, and so we're not running comments on the blog now, but I think that the swine flu vaccine has the potential to become the new world order Waterloo. We have so many people in this country who have, because of autism and vaccines, or because of Lyme disease, or because of AIDS, or because of something, have had to leave the matrix. They've had a medical reason to just, they have to leave the matrix, and they have to look deeper at what's really going on. And I think too many people have figured out that there's something that stinks about swine flu and the swine flu vaccine. And it's going to be, talk about a legal and legislative battleground, because the states control the power for vaccines and can't be overridden. Interstate travel can be controlled by the feds, but not within the state. And so as we're fighting over various economic and property issues and health reform, the push to do a mandatory vaccine is going to come down, and it's going to make things much more interesting, because the critical question is going to be, where is it that people will finally say no in enough number to shift the balance of power? And my expectation is that it may just be over mandatory vaccinations. Okay, heroes, heroes everywhere. One of the most amazing things in the third quarter, and one of the most gratifying things, was we had people popping all over the place doing just incredible and fearless work. And I wanted to name some of them. And it's funny, because the doghouse was absolutely overflowing. If the SBC was in charge of running the financial fraud doghouse in America, they'd go broke. Number one dog in the doghouse was Goldman Sachs. And it's amazing. If you go on the blog and do a search for Goldman Sachs, I tried throughout the third quarter to put up some of the most amazing stories. But what you'll see is that group of people still, is still living in a bubble, is still living in a state of arrogance, and does not understand how deep the anger is and how much it's growing yet. Now, let me walk through some heroes. Zero Hedge, one of the most popular new blogs in the financial area. There's an anonymous author who runs the site who nailed Goldman Sachs on insider trading and got labeled a conspiracy theorist until the Department of Justice attorney confirmed that Goldman had software that could, and they did this in open court, that could in fact engage in proprietary inside trading of the markets. Thus affirming Zero Hedge's story was quite amazing. It made their reputation, and now New York Magazine has an article about the Zero Hedge conspiracy. Anyway, but it an incredible example of financial insiders who've had it with the corruption and every day are just pounding the stories sort of on the inside of what's going on in Wall Street. Okay, so I have to nominate as heroes my colleagues Bill Murphy and Chris Powell, who just authorized the GATA attorneys to bring a lawsuit against the Federal Reserve. It takes a lot of guts to file a lawsuit against the Federal Reserve, but Murphy and Powell, have never slowed down on their quest to try and bring transparency to the precious metal markets. And if we want to have markets, we have to have transparency. And so, good for them. Another one I wanted to nominate for Hero Heroes is Sybil Edmonds' story on the blog of Sybil this week. Somebody once called her the most gagged woman in America. She was a translator for the FBI starting, I think, in 2005, and had to read reams and reams and reams of transcripts of phone calls and other communications that divulged incredible narcotics trafficking by the U.S. government and NATO, and all sorts of perverted and corrupt behavior by Congress men and women, and has been gagged for years and has fought like a spitfire to get the truth out, and has finally been in a position to do depositions. She's still gagged on many issues, but what she tells is just, it has your mouth on the floor. And it's funny for me, because the truth really is stranger than fiction. And it's hard for many people to fathom, the extent of what's going on. But Sybil does a great job of outing everybody in a way that's just unbelievably fearless. So bravo for her. And then I have to tell you my number one hero of the, or I should say heroes of the third quarter, is, believe it or not, these guys, I don't know how they did it. We have two researchers, and I can't even pronounce their name, Danuta Skowronski of the British Columbia Center for Disease Control and Gaston Desiers of Laval University, have come out with a paper, and they're gagged while it's going through peer review, that says if you take the vaccine, the swine flu vaccine, you are twice as likely to get swine flu as if you don't take the vaccine. And that has prompted the officials in British Columbia to say that they may cancel people taking or they're recommending people take the swine flu vaccination starting as of Monday. Now, this is this is one of the most courageous acts I've ever seen, and it just goes to show you the extent to which legitimate science can completely back up what's going on. And it's going to be very interesting because British Columbia is no small or unimportant jurisdiction, and their opinion counts. So it's going to be very easy to see what happens. Okay. Coming up in the fourth quarter, at the end of this, or during the second quarter wrap-up, I listed all the actions you can take. If you go back and listen to those or listen to the recommendations in positioning your assets for growth CD, there's nothing new to add. We know a lot of what we can do, and the question is, how do we break out the time to do it? But I encourage you to go back and listen to the second quarter wrap-up on the section of actions we can take. What is most important is in the fourth quarter and going forward, there are different ways this can go. We can keep going in the slow burn. We've been slow burning through the year. We slow burn through the third quarter, and chances are good we're going to slow burn through the fourth quarter. However, it's going to require a lot more force, whether it's war or vaccines, to keep it going. So be prepared for the slow burn. Be also prepared for Shock Doctrine USA, because sometime in the next probably 18 months, a combination of military and state and local official frustration, small business frustration, is going to reach some kind of peak, and we could see some strong shifts, and we could see a real effort by the New World Order to do in the United States what they did in Latin America. So, and who knows, things could spin out of control, as Cliff High and others have said that they might. So be prepared for it to go either way. Revisit the actions we recommend in the second quarter. I think they'll do you in very good stead. You look at our website, and we always say, who's your farmer, who's your banker? And now I'm going to add, who's your sheriff? Now's a good time to be in contact with your state and local officials, or at least those among them who have good reputations and you can trust, and certainly your local sheriff. Anything you can do that in a positive manner would be great. Watch for a lot more people stepping up and stepping out, not necessarily in the corporate media, but like all the people I just described, in lots of different walks of life. Find them, connect with them, support them. We're going to be seeing a lot more people say, I've had it, I'm out of the system, let's do something new. We don't have a let's go to the movies tonight. Next week our movie is going to be Spike Lee's documentary, When the Levees Broke, on what happened in New Orleans after Katrina. Next week, of course, is Precious Metals Market Report. There's a lot going on in that market, as you know, so I'll be over with Franklin Sanders at the top of the World Farm. And so July, that's going to be October 8th, Thursday, October 8th. So that's it for this evening, ladies and gentlemen. I and the Solari team had a very fine third quarter, and it's in no small part because of the opportunity to get to serve you. So in closing, I really want to say a very special thank you to you and yours. You're always in my thoughts and prayers. Nothing pleases me more than helping you thrive in these times, so keep the great suggestions going of what we can bring to the Solari Report that would most help you. This week I put up a quote from H.L. Hunt on the blog that I just love. He says, if this country is worth saving, it's worth saving at a profit. In that spirit, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.